afternoon. So last time, we finished up by talking about the bubble install signals that are provided for you in HCL. This is built in implementation of the logic to say, there's a register outputting a value. I want to output the same value in the next cycle, regardless of what's being input to it. Or to say, there is a register outputting a value now. I want it to output the default values, which are nops, in the next cycle, rather than whatever it would output normally. And these are the tools we're going to use to actually implement things like stalling. So rather than having to write all the logic for each of the possible signals coming out of the whatever registers need to have nops coming out of them, you're just going to set these bubble install signals to make stalling happen. And if you want to figure out how to set them, the way I recommend reasoning about it is by looking at a timeline like this. What instructions in each cycle? And you can draw lines which represent the register bank. So the line I have going down over fetch is the PC. That's what the PC is doing. And the lines I have going from fetch to decode represent the register bank that goes from fetch to decode. Now I've marked each of them with an N, if the stall and bubble should be clear, meaning we just do the normal thing and copy the value, let the instruction go through. With an S, if they should be set to stall, meaning we should ignore the value going through and keep things the same as they were last cycle. And with a B, if we should pass through a no operation value. So when we're stalling, I have here marked that we make the PC stall, meaning it stays the same, though it doesn't actually matter for rep because we're not going to care what instructions we fetch until we actually figure out where the return goes. So we'll fetch again, and the important thing is that when we're waiting for the return and we don't know what to run next, we need to make sure we don't run something, not even return again. We want to run return once, get it to the memory stage, and get its result. After that, we want to keep sending no ops down the pipeline because decode needs something to do, and so on. So we'll send a nop. And in the next cycle, we need to send another nop to decode. From decode to execute, we could set the bubble signal and send a nop, but we don't need to because there's already going to be one there from what we did before. So we only need to worry about from fetch to decode. Everything else will be taken care of by how the pipeline would work normally anyways. And eventually, we're going to figure out where our return goes to, and we're going to start advancing normally. We'll have one last step where we don't know what instruction is to run yet, so but the thing we fetched is not what we want to send to the code, so we'll send another net. That will mean setting the bubble, and then we're done, and then everything goes back to normal. So when you're implementing return, you're just going to need to figure out how to set the bubble signal for the code to make this happen. So where do we figure out, we have to write some condition. Ultimately, we're going to write HCL, where we're going to say bubble underscore D equals something. So where are we going to get the something from? What do we look at in order to make that decision? Where can we find out the information we need to know? So can anyone like describe in words like what the condition is? Like without, not don't worry about like how that turns into like variables in HCL or something like that, but describe in words, you know, if you were telling me whether or not to set the bubble signal, how you would tell me to identify whether to do it or not? Any volunteers? Yeah.
Yeah, so you're looking for data hazards, which are data dependencies.
So the bubble signal for, just for the return case.
Just for the return case?
Yeah, just for this case.
So the way we implement it is you just put three bubble signals consecutively after the return.
Okay, so three bubbles after the return. So that's one thing you could implement. You could like have a counter. You've seen how to implement that. You like have a register, which is a counter, and you could do that. There's a simpler thing we can do. There's a way I can figure out whether I need to bubble based on the information I have in this picture. So I could keep track, but we're already keeping track, actually, of how long it's been since we started the return. And the reason we're doing that is that we've sent the return down the pipeline. So if it's in decode, it's been one cycle. If it's in execute, it's been 2 cycles. If it's in memory, it's been 3 cycles. So we already have that count there because just based on where things go down the pipeline. So we can just look at where is the return in the pipeline, is it done yet? And that's equivalent to the idea, which would work, of just having an explicit counter, but we're already keeping track in the pipeline of how much of the return we've done. And so the logic is, if the return hasn't gotten to memory yet, we stall, otherwise we don't. Otherwise we send the bubble, otherwise we don't. Or hasn't finished memory yet. And we can query what that is in HCL because we know that if there's a return in decode, that means that the pipeline register for decode have the I code of return. And I have very bad handwriting today. And similarly, if there's a return in execute, we know that the I code in execute is going to be a return. So we can just check that. We can see where is the return instruction that I should be sending down the pipeline, and look at that and decide, do we still need to send bubbles, or are we done with the return? So when we've done this, we get logic like this. Is the return instruction we're currently running in decode, in execute, or in memory? If so, we want to bubble from fetch to decode. Otherwise, we don't. Except for other cases where we need to stall like this. So any questions about how this logic works? Good, ready to write that, maybe? Okay, so we've solved hazards so far with stalling. And stalling is a great technique for solving hazards because it always works. But it's a little disappointing because we have big cost. I have a here. With stalling, we're spending extra time every time we have a hazard, and it would be nice if we could maybe do a little better. So, one thing we're going to note is that, what can we do better? So let's look at each of these cases in turn. So we have our return case, and we mentioned earlier that the return case is tricky. If you want to do the return faster, you need to read the address from memory or somehow be able to know it. And the memory could be used the whole time we're executing the return, and the address might not even be written, the address we're supposed to read, until the cycle before we're supposed to read it normally. So there's not an easy shortcut. There are things you might imagine doing, but they won't always work. So we're not going to do anything to make return faster. We're going to accept that it's going to take. We're going to have 3 cycles of stalling, so the return is going to take 4 cycles in total, which is why I wrote the wrong answer here. I should probably just cross this out and do that correctly. Okay. So that's why we're going to need 4 cycles for every return. For conditional jumps, things will be a bit easier. We'll have a trick. And our trick is going to be that we're going to guess and check. So we're going to guess what the conditional jump will do. We know what both of the possibilities. That's easy to compute. It's not like return where we don't even know where it's supposed to go. With conditional jump, we know like there's 2 places it could go. We just choose one, so we make a guess, and we check it later on. So the check part is tricky. What do we do if it's wrong? And this seems like we're adding a lot of work for ourselves. We're going to start doing something, and we're going to need to somehow undo all that stuff we did. And we're going to need to add logic so we can undo it. It seems like a lot of extra bookkeeping. And it could have been. But if we look at what our pipeline does, so in fetch, the only things we change are the program counter which with a conditional jump we're going to need to fix anyways, and the pipeline registers. In decode, the only things we change are the pipeline registers. So if an instruction doesn't get beyond fetch and decode, and we want to undo it, all we need to do is forget what's in the pipeline registers and fix the program counter to actually run the right instruction. We don't have any real extra work to do. And that's going to make this guess and check very easy for our processor. So real processors often do things where they do guess, this branch prediction, as it's called, this guess and check technique, where they're checking after some things have changed. And in that case, they need to undo those changes, and it's a much more complicated process. But in our processor, we're going to figure it out early enough that there's nothing to fix beyond the pipeline registers, and we know how to do that. We have this bubble signal, which ignores what's in the pipeline registers, just discards what's there. That's going to be enough. And so when we have some code like this, our policy is that we're going to speculate every time that a conditional jump goes to the specified limit. We could have chosen something else to do. We could have chosen to always go to the next instruction instead. We could have chosen to randomly choose between the two. Our textbook authors chose to go to the label because it turns out they looked at real programs, and that's usually what real programs do, like 60% of the time. So it's a good choice. And if we're right, by making this guess, we'll be two cycles faster. And if we're wrong, we forget what happened in execute when we figure out what the result of the jump is, when we read the condition codes. And we're just as slow as we were when we were stalling. So as long as the extra logic to undo these guesses, to set the bubble signals and so on, doesn't make our pipeline slower, this is just a win. We're just making things faster. And so what this looks like when we speculate is that we just keep going, we fetch next instructions. And when we're right, we started some instructions we didn't know were supposed to happen. And once we figure out that the jump is in fact taken, we're done. We don't need to even do anything. This is simpler than what we were doing before, for the case where we speculate correctly. That it's exactly the same as doing an unconditional jump, which you already implemented, pretty simple. So the tricky case, of course, is when these instructions I've marked with a question mark aren't the ones we were supposed to run. When we fetched and started decoding instructions that aren't actually part of the program we're running. And in that case, we're going to need to figure out how to cancel. And there's a vocabulary term for this. So this is called squashing instructions. So squashing is when we speculate that this is the instruction we want to run, we start running it, and we need to undo all the things it's done. That's called squashing in general. And for us, since everything that the instruction has done is in pipeline registers, all that squashing entails for us is just discarding what's in the pipeline registers. So that's bubbling. If values like stored in condition code registers or the register file, we need to somehow like restore the old values from somewhere. But fortunately, we didn't get the instructions to go that far, so we don't have to worry about that. And if you remember what we showed you before, this means that we just set the bubble signal on the registers from fetch to decode, and from decode to execute, and that's what makes this happen. See that later. And the other thing we need to do, in addition to squashing instructions, is we need to have some logic which is going to fetch the next instruction. And this is basically the same logic we had when we were dealing with conditional jumps with stalling. It's the exact same decision. We just need to only do it when it's not taken. So any questions about the control, what what happens where in the pipeline, conditional jumps, when we do branch prediction. Apparently not, okay, or not. We'll see if there's more later. Okay, so one question we might want to answer is how much does this help us? Like, how important is it to do branch prediction? And like with the other things we've done handling hazards, it depends on the programs we're running. And for branch prediction, it depends on, you know, what type of, how many conditional jumps are there, and also how good does our branch prediction end up being. So we're using the policy that we assume every branch is taken. So we would need to know, to evaluate a program, how often are they actually taken? How correct is that? And if you really wanted, you could write a program where every single conditional jump is never taken. You could make there be absolutely no benefit. But real programs don't look like that. Real programs are probably usually going to have the jumps taken. You think about how you want to write loops, you can see why that would happen. And you can then predict based on this, knowing how much things stall, how much each of these instructions takes, you can figure out what the cycles per instruction is going to be in each of the two cases. And this is how you would compare, you know, the effects of branch prediction. And when you decide about making, you know, doing something more complicated for branch prediction, when people make that sort of decision, this is what they're looking at. Saying, am I improving the cycles instruction enough for the other cost of adding this? Like, if I need to make my cycle time slower, that's gonna offset the improvement here. If it prevents me from adding other things to the processor, that would be part of my decision. So I mentioned earlier that our actual squashing decision, that suppressing instructions, is just gonna be pipeline register. So as I said, what we're gonna do is we're not gonna stall anything because we are still just fetching new instructions. We're just going to use the bubble signal to say, hey, those instructions you were running, replace them with nots. So this is the first time we've seen us using these control signals to deliberately remove something from the pipeline. That's a thing they can do. And in this case, that's what we wanted to happen. It's not an uncommon bug for people to have that happen when it shouldn't. This is what we want to do. So we just need to figure out, when do we set those bubble signals? So what should I be looking at to set them correctly? It's going to be the same idea we have with return. So what are the conditions for me wanting to do those bubbles to squash instructions? Yes?
Well, the result of memory.
What?
Well, so like with RET, was the result of the memory stage, right?
So RET was it when we finished the memory stage, yeah.
Exactly, so it's the same thing. You're just, when you find the condition, and if it's correct, then you don't do anything.
Yeah, so we want to say, did we find the condition? Which means, did we get the jump instruction to the point where we read the condition codes? And that happens in the execute stage. So that's one question. And the other question is, was the branch not taken? As in, what we predicted it was taken, was it not taken? And so that logic looks something like this. We say, is there a jump in the execute stage? And was the branch not taken? Or is the branch taken? It's something you'll compute in the execute stage from the condition codes. It's pretty much the exact same computation you use for conditional move. And if so, you detected a mispredict, and that's one of the reasons you set the bubble signal for the fetch to decode registers to true, and one of the reasons you set the bubble signal for the decode to execute registers to true. And so that's the logic to implement this, and the other part of the logic we need is the logic to actually figure out what the PC is based on the jump not being taken. So you need to fetch a copy of what the next instruction is, which you better have somewhere. Okay, So we've seen several examples of using the bubble install signals to actually, you know, manipulate what instructions are in our pipeline. And this is something I'd like people to actually be comfortable with, so you can have some idea what happens if you do this wrong, or you need to handle a tricky case, like where we need to like deal with a stall, and there's also a branch misprediction at the same time. Like, it's easy to know what should happen, but often people mess up the logic as far as what actually happens. So here's an exercise. So I have some instructions here, which I've labeled E, A, B, C, D, E, and that's the order they were apparently fetched in, because they're in that order in the pipeline initially. And I'd like to end up that E, which was is currently in fetch, is in fetch in the next cycle. That D, which is currently in decode, is not in the pipeline in the next cycle. That C, which is currently in execute, stays in execute. That B, which is currently in memory, goes to write back, and that A doesn't appear in the pipeline anymore. So I want you to figure out, to do this, what do I need to set each of the pipeline register bubble install signals to? And also the one for the PC. And check with your neighbors. See if you agree. Okay, who's still working? No volunteers for still working. Okay, so the first thing to look at is basically, is there something different between what's there and there before? So we can go say, hey, we want fetch to stay the same, so that's a stall. Stall is what we do whenever we want something to stay the same. So fetch is a stall because we want it to stay the same. If we want to knob somewhere, then it's a bubble. So we set it to B because we want to knob in the output. For C, we want to make C still be what's here, so we're going to stall. We're going to output the C, which presumably was output in the previous cycle. And we have a knob here, so that's a B. And then we have our only normal case here, which is where we're going from memory to write back. That we actually want to go through normally, so that's normal. That's not no stall, no bubble. So any questions about this? Everyone comfortable? Yeah?
Can you go over the difference between uppercase and lowercase? what the stage is?
Oh, the uppercase and lowercase, the naming convention.
Yes.
Okay, so the question is about the stage naming convention. So the register here, we're gonna have this side is gonna be named with a lowercase f, and this side is gonna be named with an uppercase d. I'll put the d there. And there's one register here. So this is just the names for the wires at either side of the register. And the next set of registers, we're gonna have a lowercase d for the input and an uppercase e for the output. So that's just the names of the input and output signals are prefixed. And the idea is that they're prefixed by the letter of the stage. Uppercase means output, lowercase means input. The other part of this is that when we deal with the bubble signals, it's going to be bubble underscore the big letter, and that's the only one you're going to be able to use.
Okay.
If you try to use bubble underscore lowercase f, it just doesn't exist. Any other questions about this? Okay, so as I said, the main reason we're going over this is that we want you to actually be able to set this correctly, especially when if you find any tricky cases you need to deal with when you actually make a pipeline processor. And you want to know what's going on, why am I like losing instructions? You can figure this out from my knowing what happens. So we have another case where we want to get rid of data hazards, and that was we were going to get rid of stalling, and that was with data hazards. So data hazards, we're going to use this trick, which is that we're going to have values which are in our pipeline somewhere. They're waiting to get to a register file, but they aren't there yet. And we're just going to use those values even though they haven't gotten to the register file yet. And the basic observation here is that usually we compute the value before it's needed. It's not, even though it has to get to the register file and be written, usually we've already computed the value well before. And this occurred in the example I showed you to tell you about data hazards with this add processor. That 900 there, we should have read 1700. That's what the first instruction writes. And if we look in these pipeline registers, there's already a 1700 because we computed it in the previous cycle. And execute. So it's already there, the value is available. Why can't we just use it? And the answer is, well, we can. So we're gonna say that we have our situation where we have our 1700 sitting here, and we would be computing 900 as the value we read from the register file, because that was the old value, we haven't written the new value yet. And so we have both of these values are in our pipeline, and we want to actually use that 1700. So we're going to want to make an extra connection. We need to add a wire to this. So we're just going to add this connection here. We're going to send that 1700 through there. Now, we don't always want to do that because we won't always be reading from the register we just wrote. That's not every single program. So we want to make that conditional. If you want to make something conditional in hardware, we need a mux. So we're going to have a mux. And we're doing this for source A. It can also happen for source B. Same scenario, we just happen to read in a different part of the instruction the same value. And we'll deal with that in the same way. We'll make this shortcut where we'll take the value, send it, and replace what came out of the register file with that value. And we'll need to do that conditionally because not every instruction does that. So this is the extra stuff we add to the data path. Of course, we actually need to write the logic here, which figures out the input, the selector input to the mux. When do we actually use this either path or not. So I need to reason about that, and we're gonna look at register errors, because what we want to say is, let's look at the register I was supposed to read. Is that register the one that's actually on this wire that I could connect with this MUX? That's the decision we want to make. So we're gonna compare some register numbers. So let's say you want to know whether or not we do this forwarding path here, where we say that the value we read for RA is the value we should get from the end of the execute stage. So we're going to write some HCL, something like this. We're going to say debel A, normally it was just reg output A. It was just the output of the register file. Now, sometimes it's going to be this value here on this wire, which is called eval E, because that's what our textbook calls the output of the ALU that goes into the execute to next stage register file. Register bank. We want to figure out what that actually ends up being. And as a reminder, so by our naming convention, so here, this is big E underscore dest E. This here is little d underscore dest e. This here is little e underscore dest e. This here is big w underscore dest e. That was our naming convention. It goes little is the lowercase, and a letter is the input from the stage, uppercase is the output to the stage. So that's our naming convention, what these values are. And this here is E underscore val E. This here would be W underscore val. So given that, figure out what you think the answer here is. Check if you agree with your neighbor. Because when we do the highlighted path in the MUX. Okay, so who thinks the answer is A? How about B? Okay, something else. C? Okay, or D? E? Okay, so let's go through basic logic that I use to solve this. So here, One observation is we have this value eval e, and we want to know where does it come from. And the eval e value is in the execute stage. It's the output of the execute stage. And it's a value we're going to write to the register file. If you look at what we do with it, we take it, again, it sends it through to the register file. So the question we want to ask is, are we going to write it where we just read? And to know that, we need to say, well, what register number are we writing? And we can trace that input, and that's on this corresponding signal here. So this, we have a pair of values here, eval e and e dest e, which become w dest e and w val e. And that gets written to the register file. So that pair is, you know, that's the value and the register number it's going to. So that means that the correct answer is C. So because the value we're forwarding is going to go to the register dest e dest e. Because that's the two pairs that are going to go together to the write back stage at some point and actually be sent to the register file. And that's, you know, the value we want to read. We want to pretend it was already written. So the other cases here, we're taking a value from the wrong stage, a register number from a different stage, which is not actually paired correctly with this eval e value. It's not the actual place it goes. It might coincidentally be the same, but it doesn't come from the same instruction. There's no reason to believe that. So any questions on this? So obviously this is good to know about because you'll need to implement this. Okay. So here I showed you two places where we need to forward. We're taking the value we're writing, sending it to the register files. In our full pipeline, we have a whole bunch of other cases where we might need to forward. So here I have some assembly, and I have it written down like what stage everything would be in, assuming we don't need to do any stalling. And if you want to figure out what forwarding happens, basically you go through this and you look for dependencies. You look for cases where you write a value and then read it. And then you say, how is that value getting there? And you can look at what stage do we need the value in, or what stage are we going to read the value in, where does it actually get produced? And from that you can see if we need forwarding. So for example, between this add and subtract, we're reading our line in the decode stage. We want to get the value because we need it for the execute stage. And it's not going to be the value in the register file because the add instruction you want to get the value from hasn't written it back yet. So we need forwarding, and that forwarding is going to be from the end of the add's execute stage to the end of our decode stage. It's going to be exactly the forwarding path I just showed you. And we can keep going. So we have our another example here. So that R9 we wrote is actually read again by RM move Q. So we need to forward that too, because it's going to be reading it just before we actually write the value. Because remember, the value is stored at the end of the write back stage. So that's another case where we need to forward. So we need another shortcut, which goes from just before the register file and right back to the end of the code. So that's another shortcut, another case in our mocks that we're going to need to implement. And we can keep going through this. So we have R11. It's written in subtract. It's read by the MRMoveQ instruction to compute the address. So it needs it at the end in time for execute, so we're going to forward that value. Same forwarding path we saw in the first case. Except to a different register replacement. And we also, in this case, we have to forward a value to the RM move queue instruction from subtract. And that's, you know, another forwarding of that value. In this case, we need to go take the value from memory, because that's where it happened to be. even though the memory stage doesn't do any computation or accessing anything, we still pass the values through it, and when we're trying to read registers for our remove queue, that's where the value you want is actually going to be. It's not going to be in the register file. So that's where we're going to get it. And we have one last case. We have a case where we write a value in mrmoveQueue. Sorry, read a value in mrmoveQueue from memory, and we need to get it in the XOR instruction. So we're going to take that value we just read from memory and send it to the registers that are after the register file that contain the value we just read, in place of what the register file would say, the old value. So we have a whole bunch of these paths we need to implement, so you'll need to enumerate all of them. That's why I did not draw a picture with all the paths on them, because there's a lot of them. But once we've done this, we can deal with most of our data hazards. We just need to handle everything where the value is available early enough. We just need to make sure the shortcut exists so it's going to be actually sent. So there's some trickiness in this. Oh, one last mention, R9 here, doesn't need forwarding. Because we write the value and then read it after we write it. Okay. So there's some trickiness in implementing forwarding like this. Some cases that you have to consider or else you'll get wrong. So one example is here. So the first data instruction here writes R8, and two instructions later we read it. So you might say, okay, so I'm going to forward a value from the memory stage where that for that R8 we're about to write, and I'm going to send it to that last add instruction. So what's wrong with this? Why don't we want to do this? So it's the value of R8, yeah.
R8 being set again before that?
Yeah, so that's the value of R8. It's a real value that's going to be in the register file. But it's not the one we care about. The one we care about is the one just before this instruction that's going to be, you know, if we were executing one instruction at a time, and that's the one from the second app. So we actually want to forward from the execute stage of the second add to decode, not from the memory stage of the first add to decode. So we need to make sure that we do the correct forwarding path, the one which gives us the most recent value. So if we have a choice between multiple, we better choose the most recent. And making it easy to support this is the reason why, probably, HCL's case syntax evaluates the expressions in order. So this makes this easy to implement. So if we're writing this, we're going to write, you know, our forwarding paths for, say, val A, in order. We're going to say, if we're forwarding from the end of execute, you know, set val E, we're forwarding from the end of memory, set M val E, and we're going to handle the cases in that sort of order so that the execute case takes precedence. So we'll take it from execute if it's there. Only if that doesn't work, we'll look in memory. And only if it's not in memory, we'll look in write back, and only if it's not in write back, we'll actually take the value from the register file. And obviously, this sort of thing, if you don't do it right, is a very subtle bug. So you get this, you get your processor implementation where only certain very specific programs do the wrong thing, and they're just getting a wrong value for a register. If you change anything around the instruction, which is getting the wrong value, it doesn't happen anymore because you've changed whether there's conflicts or not. So something to be aware of for that reason. So another thing to note is that you can forward twice. This is not uncommon. So if we write a value, write R8, write R12, and access both of them from an instruction, it's going to have two values forwarded to it. And that's normal. And that's pretty common. There's lots of instructions where both of their operands aren't going to come from the register file. They're going to come from elsewhere in the pipeline. And this happens pretty naturally. We just have forwarding cases for every value. So that's everything about forwarding. So it's easier to explain than implement because there's just all these tricky cases which are a little hard to debug, and you have to enumerate all the possibilities and make sure you don't miss any. But the conceptual concept is just we make a shortcut and we make sure that the register numbers match up, and it's the most recent thing when we take the shortcut. So any questions about forwarding in general? So far, it's looked like forwarding solves all our data hazards problems. Why do they even bother explaining stalling? For data hazards, we don't do it. Well, there's one case we're gonna have trouble. So that's if we load a value and then try to do some computation on it. So the earliest we could forward the value is at the end of memory, because that's when it's loaded, and that's too late. We forward it to the end of the execute stage, we wouldn't, and by that time, we have already done computation on the wrong version of the value. It's too late to fix anything. So what we have to do in this case is stall. But we only stall one cycle, because one cycle is just enough so we can actually forward the value to decode. So we're going to use stalling and forwarding in cases like this. So we'll stall one cycle just enough so forwarding can work. And this general pattern is what our book calls the load use hazard. You load a value for memory and try to use it immediately afterwards. And what our textbook would do is you just detect whether you're loading a value and then using it by looking at the register numbers in your pipeline and use that to decide whether or not to stall. So there's another special case of this, which is if we're doing a load followed by a store. And in our textbook, what they're going to tell you to do is they're going to tell you you only forward to the end of decode, so you stall in this case. But I have this path listed on the slide where we can forward things. We can say take the value that came out of memory and just have it replace the value we're sending through from the decode stage in the execute stage. Like, this is something you could do. It's not hard, but our textbook doesn't do it. Our textbook only forwards to the end of decode. But many real processors do this, so you don't technically need to stall in this case, as long as you implement this forwarding path. Now, we're not gonna have you do that in assignments just because you like being consistent with the textbook, but I want you to be aware that there's other ways you can use forwarding to solve a few more problems than we saw. The general question you should have is, when do we actually need the value? And in the case of this store instruction, for the value we're writing, for RBX, we need the value at the point of the memory stage. And so as long as we can find the value elsewhere in the pipeline before then, we're fine. Okay. So after we've done all our forwarding, all our prediction, the big question is, where do we actually need to stall? What's remaining? What are all our cases? So we have one case we mentioned, which was that return case, where we need the output of memory in fetch. So we need to do, so RETs are the case where we do that. That's a case where we need to stall. We don't have a better way of handling that because we can't do prediction of where the RET goes. In the case of conditional jumps, we just do prediction, so we don't stall, but we might waste a couple instructions if we predict wrong. And we also have the case where we need to get the output from memory and need it in execute. That's not going to work out, so we need to stall. So anything where we do an MRMove queue or a pop queue, just remember that MRMove queue is not the only instruction that reads memory into a register. So either of those followed by some instruction which uses that value. Those are cases where we're going to need to stall. And as you can see from the early example, we just need to stall for one cycle. That one cycle is going to be enough so we can use forwarding to actually send the value through. So any questions about all the ways we resolved hazards? So this is sort of the final pipeline processor we're ending up with. It's how fast it's going to do everything. So we have basically one instruction every cycle, except for hazards. And because we handle data hazards mostly with forwarding, hazards are pretty rare. So our hazards are mispredicted branches, which are hopefully rare because hopefully we can usually predict branches correctly. If you want some intuition about whether that's true, most branches are loops. So as long as our loops are mostly jumping from the end of the loop to the beginning, which would be taken branches, well, we get them mostly right. And the other case is returns. So if we don't have too many returns, and we don't have too many low use hazards, we're going to have a processor which does almost one cycle per instruction. It's going to be a little slower than that, but hopefully not too much. And of course, this depends on the program we have. I could write a program which is just all return instructions and make it seem really inefficient. I could write a program which is all load use hazards and make it seem really inefficient. But typical programs are going to look different, especially since compilers are going to pay attention to what works well. And for example, compilers will avoid low-use hazards on platforms where they matter. That's something a compiler can do by just writing the assembly differently in most cases. So this is our overall pipeline. So I'm going to talk about some general issues with pipelining. So one thing is about vocabulary. So we have this term dependency. Dependency means one thing uses the result of another. We have data dependencies, where we use a value from another thing, and control dependencies, where we depend on a PC computation from an instruction. So dependencies is, do we need the result? There are hazards. Hazards are just about, will it work in the pipeline? Before we did any of this extra work with stalling or forwarding or branch prediction, did this thing already work or not? If it did work, it's not a hazard. Even if it's a dependency, it's not a hazard. If it didn't work, it is a hazard. So that's the test. So what is a hazard depends on a particular pipeline. If I change the pipeline, it changes what the hazards are. So, since we know like how we're going to handle our hazards and such, let's go through an example and refresh your memory about that. So here's a bunch of assembly instructions. So first, find all the dependencies. In this case, there's only going to be data dependencies because there's no control flow instructions here. Figure out which of these are hazards in our pipeline. So we have to, I have to tell you which pipeline because, for example, in our single cycle processor, none of them are hazards. It just works fine. And which of these are we going to resolve with forwarding or you know, not use techniques like stalling, that is. So I would write down an answer. I would write things down because I will consistently make off by one errors anytime I try to figure something like this out. So I'd recommend writing things down and compare your answer with your neighbors if you can.
Yeah, it's a bit tough. So if it's a data outlet, it has a dependency use case, right? So the data hazard is also a dependency, right?
Well, where we have dependencies,
okay, who needs more time? Okay, a couple people who has an answer. Okay, reasonable people. So I'll start, hopefully you'll catch up. So first, we're a dependency. So dependencies, or in this case, are gonna be data dependencies. So I look at, whenever I write something, where is that written? So I can look first at RBX here and say I'm writing to RBX here. Where do I read it? I don't read it here. Don't read it in sub Q. I remove Q or the first add Q, but I read in the second one. So that is a dependency. So I just look at values and I do the same thing here. So RCX, I write it here and you might say, oh, I'm reading it here. And that is true. But it's not a dependency because I'm not reading the value of RCX that sub wrote. I'm reading the value I remove Q wrote. So there's no dependency there, but there is a dependency from I remove Q to the add Q. There's no dependency from the subtract to that add because that's not actually the value we're reading. It's the same register, but not the same value. It's not going to create any hazards or anything like that. So then we look again, so we have add writes to R10, the add following it reads from R10, so that's another dependency. So these are all the dependencies. And to figure out which of these are hazards, which these are actually, data hazard, your question? No, okay. Or data hazards, we need to actually know where things are gonna be in the pipeline if we don't do any stalling. So I've written out pipeline stages and bad handwriting. And we can say, okay, so we have RBX, it's gonna write the value, it's naturally gonna be written at the end of write back here. And the question we have is, does this add instruction read it after that? And the answer is yes, because its decode is after that write back stage. So there's no hazard there. Then for I remove Q, we write the value over here, but we read it before we write it. So there's a hazard there. If we don't do anything, we're not gonna read the result of that I remove Q, we're gonna read some older version of RCX. So there is a hazard. In fact, we can resolve it with forwarding. So if we forward from the end of execute to the end of decode, that's actually gonna send the value and that will resolve the hazard with forwarding. We don't need to do any stalling. That fixes the whole thing. And from add here, from add to add, we write R10 over way off the slide after we read it here. So we need to do forwarding to solve this, and we can do forwarding. The value is computed at the end of execute. We can forward that to the end of the code. NAT forwarding works. So everything but our longest dependency here was a hazard, and they all could be resolved with forwarding. We didn't have that load use case where we had to stall. Didn't have any sorts of other hazards where we had to stall or do something else. So any questions about the answer here? So one more example. Yes.
I was wondering for the zero in bracket, parentheses, is it necessary to put a zero?
It is not. It defaults. The default is zero if you don't specify it. That's what the last one instruction is. Okay, who's still working? A couple people? Okay. A little more time. So I'll start by going over dependencies. So we have, in this example, something we didn't have before, which is a control dependency. What runs after J&E depends on the result of J&E, kind of, but this is a special case where both the options are the same, so it's ambiguous. But wanted to make it clear what was happening as far as data, so I didn't do different paths. So then we have our data dependencies. So we have RBX is written by this move instruction, this load instruction, and red here, and nowhere else. RCX is written by this ADDQ instruction, and it's read by this other ADDQ instruction. Note that having a jump doesn't make it not a dependency. We still read a value we wrote. And you might have said that RCXA, it's used by MRMoveQ, but it's only written, so it's not actually a dependency. So we don't actually care what the old value was. And similarly, we can look at RDX here. This is read by ADDQ, written by ADDQ, read by MRMoveQ to compute the address. So then the question is, which of these are resolved with forwarding? Well, which are resolved with forwarding? So the control dependency is a hazard, because otherwise we wouldn't know what to do in our pipeline. And that's resolved with branch prediction, not forwarding.
Would the jump instruction would the ADDQ before the jump instruction be a dependency for the jump instruction because of the condition codes?
It running depends on the, yes. Yes, so there's a hidden data dependency. So the question is, would the jump instruction depend on the previous ADDQ because of the condition codes? And the answer is yes. So that's a dependency I forgot to mention, which is important. So there's a data dependency here on the condition codes. So there's a data dependency of sorts, or control dependency. I don't think people are clear on exactly which type it is, but there's a dependency between those two instructions because of the condition codes. So it's another dependency we need to deal with in our pipeline. Fortunately, that dependency is not a hazard, because we always read and write the condition codes in the same cycle. So it doesn't create a hazard for that reason. We just have our control hazard because we don't know how to execute conditional jumps given when we read the condition codes in our natural pipeline. So these other cases, they're all cases where if you look, it's where the decode, where we're reading the value, is before the write-back is finished. So all these other data dependencies rely on forwarding, because we're reading a value from a register, we're reading it before it's actually written, so we have to use forwarding to get that value without the register file. So all the other data dependencies are resolved with forwarding. Okay. So that's an example of dependencies and hazards there. So you should be comfortable with. So I note that we have a particular pipeline design. The one our textbook has chosen, it's chosen because it has a nice division of stages, but maybe that's not the only thing you want to do. Maybe you find out that you get a better cycle time and trade off with hazards and such if you divide things up differently. So you might need to consider what happens with a different pipeline. And real processors don't have 5-stage pipelines, they have some different number, usually. So, for example, if we have a 4-stage pipeline, that means that some things which were hazards won't be hazards anymore. It gets rid of hazards. Of course, the cost is that we made our cycle time longer. Here we're combining execute and memory. That might take a while. We also might make our pipelines longer. So let's say we split execute into 2 stages. So then that's going to make hazards different. And because we're making a longer pipeline, it's probably going to make hazards worse. So let's say we do forwarding to handle hazards where possible, stalling if we can't do that. What is actually just going to happen here? And the way I recommend going about this is I've started writing out sort of what stage each instruction is in, like continue that and figure out, okay, at the end of decode, I need these values, where do they come from? And see if that lines up in time, or if you have to delay things, if you have to forward things in order to make that happen. So here, this is a different pipeline, so I've split up execute. There's So the Xcube stage, we've basically taken our ALU, divided it into two pieces, separated by pipeline registers. So who needs more time? Okay, enough people. You're allowed to talk about this. You don't have to do it in silence. Okay, I want to finish up before we run out of time, so I'll start with an explanation. So as I said, the strategy is you write down what happens in what stage each thing is in, and you figure out where do we get the value. So for example, the second add instruction, we need R9. R9 is set by the previous instruction, so we need to get it. And if we try to forward it to the end of the code, which is when we need it, because we actually need it for execute, that's too early. It's not actually computed yet. It's not ready because we need the second part of execute in this split pipeline tab. So that means we need to stall, and if we stall one cycle, that's enough to make this forwarding work. And when we stall, everything else moves. So our other two instructions move. And then we look at the next instruction. So the add REX and R9. R9 is set by the first instruction. The value isn't written, but we're into code, so we need to do forwarding, but we didn't need to stall any more than we already did. And then the last instruction here reads from R9 and from RBX. So R9 is set by the previous add queue instruction, and RBX is set by the add before that. So we have two forwarding paths, and it looks like both of them work, because the value is computed in time before when we need it. This is assuming that we can forward after decode. If we couldn't forward after decode, we need to stall a couple extra times. forward to after decode, that is. Okay, so that's what I have for today. So next time we'll finish up some details of pipelining and move on to talking about caches.